Chumash Vayikra is referred to as Torah's Kohanim, as it is. There is certainly a special niche for Parsha within Vayikra of Emor, which has the unique mitzvah of the Kohanim, Emor El HaKohanim. And it refers to the special status of the Kohanim. They have special mitzvahs, certain places they can't go, certain people they can't marry, certain things they have to do. And it's all detailed. Emor el ha-Kohanim b'nei Aaron. What I would like to focus on for a while is Pasuk Ches. For having discussed a number of these special mitzvahs of the Kohanim, the Pasuk states, V'kidashto. Not only is it stated in Pasuk Vav, Kedoshim yiyu lelokeim, which really covers all of their special status with its own mitzvah, Kedoshim yiyu lelokeim, the Torah now turns to the Jew, to the non-Kohen, and says, V'kidashto. In what way am I meant to make the Kohen holy? What does that mean, V'kidashto? I know what it means to be Mekadosh the Chodesh. I know what it means to be Mekadosh a Korban. How am I Mekadosh a Kohen? And this word V'kidashto is discussed twice, or more correctly, in two veins in the Talmud. In Maseches Yevamos, Daf Peches Amud Beis, discusses the question as to whether or not these special applications for the Kohen are optional in any way, or are they non-negotiable? Can the Kohen say, I abdicate my kahuna, not the avodah, and not the restrictions, and he'd like to marry someone that the Torah does not allow him to marry? To that end, says the Talmud, V'kidashto means the laws of kahuna are to be enforced by the Beis Din, representing the Jewish people. And therefore, V'kidashto, in a sense, doesn't mean sanctify him to a greater degree than before, but it means see to it that he acts in accordance with his sanctity. So V'kidashto actually does not give us a new mitzvah, but rather it underscores the fact that the existing mitzvahs are absolutes. V'kidashto bal korcho. Even if he's not interested, he's not allowed to be not interested. He's a Kohen. A very different approach, or very different emanation from the word V'kidashto, is to be found in Maseches Gittin, Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis, which discusses there, in the course of many other things, the order of Kriyas HaTorah. And as we know, Kriyas HaTorah always begins with a Kohen. And the Gemara is looking to find out the reason why that is. Why should the Kohen go first? And it actually brings a number of psukim, if one looks in the Talmud there, but certainly the enduring resonance of that section of the Talmud is the word V'kidashto. V'kidashto means you need to accord the Kohen special status. Or more correctly, you need to accord him privileges in keeping with his special status. Liftach Rishon, he opens first, he reads first, he benches first, and all of those things to give precedence to the Kohen. And it's interesting to note, not only is the Torah, as shall we say, one of the bylaws of the institution of Kahuna, telling the Jewish people to give this special status to the Kohen, but according to no less authorities than the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch, this is actually a separate mitzvah of Taryag, which is interesting. One could have understood that it is a branch of the general mitzvahs of Kahuna. Sefer HaMitzvos, mitzvahs asei lamed beis, says the Rambam, to accord special status to the Kohen. And the Sefer HaChinuch, as is often the case, follows suit in mitzvah reish samach tes, to give precedence and accord this privileged status to the Kohen. And we should know that with regards to treating the Kohen in this special way, There is a very striking statement which is to be found in the Yerushalmi, in Maseches Brachos, Perek Ches, Halacha Hei. That's how the Yerushalmi just divides the Mishnayos into halachos, calls them halachos. And there, Shmuel states, Kol hamishtamish b'kohen. If a person uses a kohen, has a kohen to do a job for him, or to serve him, ki'ilu mo'al. It is if he has misappropriated sacred property. As surely as something, an item that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, one is not allowed to use it for his own purposes, so too the Kohen belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, and one is not allowed to use him for his own purposes. Ad kedei kach. And of course, for those of us who have Kohanim living amongst us, so we need to find out exactly how things fall on a practical plane. Does that mean that I cannot employ a Kohen? Does that mean a Kohen can't do a favor for me? I mean, how do things look lemaisa? And if we begin by asking the question, we say to the Kohen, he should do everything first. He should partake first within a meal. He should be offered first. I mean, he really is this special person. But is it acceptable, or even allowed, for the Kohen to waive that privilege, as if to say, thank you, I appreciate it, not necessary. Someone else can go first, I don't mind. Is that acceptable? Or is it non-negotiable, again? There are some institutions of Kavod that one can waive, and some that you can't. A parent could be mochel on their Kavod, a king cannot. What about a Kohen? And this question is addressed by the great Maharam Mirotenburg, Rabbi Numeir Mirotenburg, the Rebbe of the Rosh. This is in Germany, one of the great Balei HaTosfos. And the Maharam Mirotenburg says, it is acceptable. For your part, you need to accord him all the privileges. For his part, he's allowed to waive them. And says the Rabbi Numeir, I will prove it to you. You see, the Gemara in Gittin, which talks about the order of laning. First Kohen. Kohen always goes first. Now what's interesting is, the Mishnah explained that the reason is, Mipnei Darkei Shalom. To keep the peace. How's that meant to keep the peace? Because if you don't have someone who is set, who always goes first, so then the question will be, well, then who should go first? If it's not a question of aristocracy, all of a sudden it becomes a question of meritocracy. And the question as to who is the most meritocratous tends to be a subject of a machlokas, specifically between those involved, those under consideration. And therefore, it's fascinating, says the Mishnah, in order to preserve the peace. Now, it's interesting that preserving the peace must be more than a euphemism for just delaying the war until Shlishi, if you know what I mean. Enough blood has been spilt over that. But people have time to simmer down. And in any case, you're not first. So it's a question of who comes third. I think that the sting has been taken out. That's the psychology behind the Kohen goes first. Because what can you do? Not everyone's a Kohen. And he's a Kohen. And we love him. And then he goes first. And no hard feelings. Even within the institution of Kahuna, everything is in the mind. It's possible for... It's all in the eye of the beholder. I was told of a story, there was a Kehila who only had one Kohen. So he gets Kohen. But every once in a while, there would be a visiting Kohen. So no, he's the visitor, so they would be mechabitim with Kohen. And after this happened a few times, so the resident Kohen went down to the Gabbai and said, I think I begin to understand. You only give me Kohen when you have no one else to give me. So anything is possible. The sense of kavod can bring a person to the hallucinogenic. But it's a matter of Darkei Shalom. And in fact, so the Gemara asks the question, why are you saying Darkei Shalom? It's the Araisa. Why are you saying that the Kohen goes first to keep the peace? The Kohen goes first to fulfill the mitzvah of Vikidashto. Those are two separate things. So in what respect does the Mishnah say Mipnei Darkei Shalom? And the Talmud responds and says that it's mipnei darkei sholem, because even if the Kohen is prepared to waive his right to go first, that would be an interesting situation. They say, "Are you a Kohen?" Yes, I'm a Kohen, but I don't mind if someone else goes first. To that end, says the Mishnah, don't do that. If you do that, you're asking for trouble, because there'll be machlokus as to who goes first. So we see within the context of a shul, and there's no better place for machlokus than a shul, that he's not allowed to waver his privileged status. Ad kedei kach.
But they do waver.
Stage by stage. Says Marami Rottenberg, what we see from here is that were it not for the fact that the shul is a place where machlokas is likely to happen because there's lots of people there and it's very public and sensitive and etc., were it not for that fact, we have no problem in principle with the Kohen waving the cover that's due him. It's just very ill-advised in shul. But the Talmud itself states that this is only true for shul. But for example, in a seuda, where the default is always to be mechabit the Kohen, that he should bench, he should lead the zimun, but there is no problem whatsoever with him being mochel and with him saying, no, please, I'm happy for someone else to lead the benching. And no one really had a machlokas about that. And in fact, that is our practice. And that's why the one who leads the zimun, he will say, birshus. He will ask permission from birshus, balabais, hakohanim, if there are kohanim present. And that's why. He's really asking birshus. It's interesting, just thinking aloud, that the way it normally works is the balabais will turn to one of the guests and ask them to bench. And if he's in on kohen, he will ask birshus of the kohanim. I've never seen anyone say that actually the balabayit, he should ask rishus of the Kohanim before offering the benching to someone else, because he's the one who's initiating it. It's a bit awkward for the Kohen to say no once it's already, the ball is rolling. But that's not the way it works. The balabayit chooses whoever he wants, and then that person asks. It's a courtesy, of course. I've never known a Kohen to object when someone says rishus, to deny rishus. And therefore what we see is, it's very important, that when it comes to vikidashto, to accord honor to the Kohen, for your part you have to accord honor, for his part he can waive it. The only exception is Leini. So says Maharami Rottenburg. But what about the second issue? And we should understand, these two are not the same. The second issue of having a Kohen serve you, there's room to understand that that's slightly graver than the first issue of just not making him go first. I mean, here he is serving you. Is that... And Shmuel said it's like me'ila. Me'ila, misappropriation of sacred property. That doesn't really sound very negotiable. Of course, that does mean, say the poskim, that you can hire him to do a job for you, because you can actually pay for something that's hegdish also, and that's called redemption. So the fee of the Kohen for whatever job you hire him to do, that's the pidyon of his holy services. But what about to ask him to do a favor? And interestingly, one of the other Rishonim, one of the later Rishonim, Hagohos Mordechai, Rabbeinu Mordechai Ashkenazi, he quotes an episode that happened with Rabbeinu Tam and one of his Talmidim. Rabbeinu Tam had a certain Talmud of his, who was a Kohen, who was waiting on him, who was serving him. And the question came up, is it acceptable? He's a Kohen. And one of the other Talmidim there, his name is, it's a very unusual name, his name is Rabbeinu Peter. That's how it's commonly pronounced. Rabbeinu Peter, which is a lot of theories as to how he got a name like that. Baliatosis did not commonly carry Christian names. Some suggest he was a Bechor, actually, from the expression Peter Rechem. And others say that perhaps it should be pronounced Pater, as if his name was Abba, then it would be Rabbeinu Peter. In any case, he was one of the great Talmidim. He's mentioned a number of times, the Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam. He was killed in the Crusades, the Second Crusades of the 1100s. And Rabbeinu Peter stepped into to the fray here and said that as long as the Kohen is mochel, as long as he doesn't mind, it is acceptable to have him serve the Yisrael, to do a favor or to perform some service for the Yisrael. And he proves it in the most interesting way. The Talmud in Maseches Kiddushin, Daf Kaf Aleph Omed Beis, discusses the question as to the institution of Eved Ivri, A person could become an Eved Ivri for a number of reasons, but his term of service is 6 years. What if he wants to stay on past the 6 years? So as we know, I'd like to stay. He can stay till the Yovel. But what happens is, there's a certain mark that's made on him, right? And he goes through what's called Ritzia. His ear is pierced. The top part of the ear is pierced. And the Talmud states in Maseches Kiddushin that an Eved Ivri who happens to be a Kohen is not eligible to remain as an Eved till the Yovel, what's called Eved Nirza. And the reason why is because the act of piercing his ear turns him into a Balmum. And as we see in this week's Parsha, Kohen cannot become a Balmum. Ad kedei kach. Says Rabbeinu Peter, I have a problem. Now, I have no problem with a Kohen being an Eved Ivri for the first 6 years, because that's wages. I mean, if he stole, he deserves it. Or if he fell on hard times, so he's working his way out. That's work. But when he wants to stay beyond the 6 years, that's love of servitude. He is offering his services, in a sense, free of charge. He doesn't owe any money anymore. He elects to stay on. That should be forbidden. He's a Kohen. He's not allowed to serve his master. And yet we see from the Talmud that were it not for the fact that the act of piercing makes him into a Balmum, we would have no problem in principle with him being retained as an Eved. He's a Kohen. What is the resolution? Because apparently if the Kohen is Mochel, if he waives his rights, so then he can work for you. He can do whatever you want. That was the great, it's a classic proof from Rabbeinu Peter, because it's so not the focus of what the Gemara is saying. But that's the job of the Mefarshim, to catch all of the emanations of what's happening from the Talmud. We should know, by the way, I mentioned really parenthetically, but there are those who say that this touches on an interesting question. Namely, is it acceptable for one Kohen to have another Kohen serve him? For what will you say? I'm a Kohen. To which the response is, and so am I. So is it only for a non-Kohen to have a Kohen serve him? Or even for a Kohen? And that's a lengthy debate amongst the Mefarshim. But what's interesting is, if it should be the case that it's permissible for one Kohen to have another Kohen serve him, then we could understand why the Talmud needed to disqualify him staying on by virtue of the fact that the piercing of the ear makes him a Balmum, because that is much more inclusive. It would even include a case where his master is also a Kohen, so there would be no issue anymore of a Kohen serving a non-Kohen because his master is a Kohen. It breaks down over the fact that the piercing of the ear makes him into a Balmum. That's the response of certain Mefarshim. But in any case, the consensus of the Poskim is that even with regards to having a Kohen serve you, if he is Mochel, if it's really what's considered Mechila and he waives his rights, it's Mutter. And this is formulated by the Ramah in the end of Kriyas HaTorah, Hilchas Kriyas HaTorah. In the Orachayim Simin Kuf Kaf Ches Si'if Mem Hei, the Ramah says also lehishtamish b'kohen. In principle, forbidden. Afilu b'zman hazeh. Even nowadays, when there's no Beis Hamikdash, one shouldn't think it's tied to the Mikdash. Dehevi kemoel behekdash. It's like you're misappropriating hekdash. Im lo machalaka, unless he was mochel, which of course are the magic words. If he was mochel, then it's okay. What's interesting is, we have a problem in Parshanut. So far we've discussed sources from the Talmud, and we've really left the Pasuk alone for a while, but we should go back. And the reason why is because we should remember, let's refresh. There are two lessons that we learn from the word Vikidashto. Lesson number one, the laws of Kahuna are enforceable and non-negotiable. That's the first lesson that we learned from the Talmud in Yevamos. He wants to marry someone he's not allowed to marry. It's not up to him. One needs to enforce his kohuna status. Lesson number two, v'kidashto, the Talmud in Gittin told us, give him privileged status. The problem is, if you put these two together, we should have a difficulty. Because we've already seen from lesson number one that whatever is learned from v'kidashto is non-negotiable. It is an absolute. It's not subject to whether he's interested in or not. So when we learn the second limit that you need to accord him privileged status, why is he able to waive that? Were we not just told that the kidashto is an absolute and has to be enforced, even if he doesn't want? So how is it that if he doesn't want the kavod, we say kvodo mochel? That is the question of the Taz. Now, interestingly, the Taz is commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, but the answer to all of this will come from considering Rashi, or begin, by looking at Rashi on the Chumash. For Rashi, if we look at Pasuk Ches, if you have the Rashi in front of you, has two comments, and we'll preface by reading the entire Pasuk. V'kidashto, a word which is now in our system. V'kidashto ki eslechem elokecha hu makrib. That's the first part of the Pasuk. The second part is, kadosh yelach ki kadosh ani Hashem mikadishchem. So actually, the Pasuk has told us two things. We don't know what they are, we just know there's two of them. Number one, v'kidashto, and number two, kadosh yelach. And now, let us put names to faces. Let us see what we learn from these two things. Rashi, on the word v'kidashto, comments, al korcho, even against his will. If he marries someone he's not meant to marry as a Kohen, shim lo ratzu legarsha, halkehu, v'yasrehu, ad shi'igaresh. You have to put the pressure on him until the union ceases. That's lesson number one. Number two, kadoshi yelach. What does that teach us? Says Rashi, nahog bo kedusha, act in accordance, give him holy status. Liftoach rishon b'chol davar, let him open first everything. Ulevarech rishon b'suda, he should be the one to bench first. So what have we seen from Rashi? What we've seen is, we take it in abstract, that actually these two lessons are not both coming from the same word of v'kidashto. V'kidashto teaches us to enforce the prohibitions of the Isser, and then the next part of the pasuk, kadosh yelach, is what teaches us how you're meant to relate to him. He should be kodesh in your eyes. Let him go first for everything. Now, so far, if all we had was Rashi, everything would be fine, because Rashi really has given two separate departments. The problem is, the Talmud didn't speak about it that way. The Talmud identifies as the basis for both of these laws the same word, v'kidashto. So what about that? Says the Vilna Gaon, in the Sefer Aderes Eliyahu, we need to know that it is the way of the Talmud, often, and it's very interesting if we could put ourselves back into the time before chapter and verse, the way the Talmud identifies the source for a certain drasha is often to tell you the beginning of the pasuk, so that you know which pasuk you're talking about, even if the halacha at hand isn't coming from the beginning of the pasuk. In other words, to get straight to our case at hand, if the Talmud has told us that there's a special mitzvah to give privileged status to the Kohen, and the source is v'kidashto, what it means is this is sourced in the pasuk of v'kidashto, but not necessarily in the word v'kidashto, somewhere in the pasuk that begins v'kidashto. And says the Vilna Gaon, and why do I say this? Because Rashi adds a most important word in his commentary to the Talmud there in Gittin, when it explains that the Kohen goes first because of v'kidashto, says Rashi, v'gomer. V'gomer translates as etc. And etc. here is the magic word. In other words, says the Gaon, what Rashi's doing is, he's telling you, as much as the Torah has said v'kidashto, yes, it comes from the pasuk of v'kidashto, but read on, because it's not coming from the word v'kidashto. You read further into the pasuk, etc., v'gomer, finish the pasuk, and you'll get to where the actual source of the second halach is from the second half of the pasuk, kadosh yihyelach. And therefore, we have now made the peace, and in the course of so doing, answered the question of the Taz. Because the question of the Taz was, how is it possible for the Kohen to waive the special status that you're meant to give to him? He should go first, and he can't serve you, and all of those things. But that's learned from v'kidashto. And we know that what's learned from v'kidashto is non-negotiable. But according to the analysis of the Vilna Gaon, these two halakhas do not come from the same place. The enforcing of his prohibitions is from Rikidashta, that's non-negotiable. But the giving him a special status, that comes from the second half of the pasuk, Kadoshi Yelach, and nowhere is it stated that that is in, has to be enforced. It's entirely up to him. Ritzono shel Adam, Zehu Kvodo. If he wants to go first, you need to let him go first, and if he doesn't want, you don't have to force him for sure. And that again is the minhag. I should say, as a kind of a haftorah to this discussion, I would be remiss in terms of my own shevet if I didn't raise the accompanying question, is what about a levi? Does one have to give, let's say there's no Kohen around, is there an inyan that the levi should bench first? And of course the background to the question is, if we go back to Kriyas HaTorah, so remember, Kohen comes first, but levi always comes second. I've long since resigned myself to the fact that I will probably never get Shlishi. Life in Shul is much easier for me now. So the Levi comes after the Kohen. Is that true in life as well? And this question is discussed by the Poskim and the Mogen Avraham in Arachayim Simin Reish Aleph. He directs our attention to the piyut that people say at a bris. There's a special zimun that it has the refrain, Nodele Shimcha B'Sechem Menai Bruchem Atem L'Hashem. That's the chorus, so to speak. And there's a number of stanzas. He asks, Birushus this, Birushus this, Birushus this. And stanza number three is, he says, Birushus HaKohanim V'Halaviyim Ekro L'Elokei HaEvrim V'Gomer. Now, says the Mogen Avraham, so what? This is the only formal Birushus that we have. And you see that who's ever benching asks Rishus not only from the Kohanim, but also from the Levium. Apparently, they also take precedence in the absence of the Kohanim. However, says the Mogen Avraham, you should also know, and this is a nice discussion for a table around the bris, that there are two girsaos in that stanza of the Birshus. Most people have the girsa Birshus HaKohanim VeHaLevium. But there is also a nusach which says, Birshus HaKohanim HaLeviim, which is the way the Torah refers to the Kohanim. It's the full title of the Kohanim. And therefore, if you take out the Vav, you see what can happen when you take out a Vav? If it's HaKohanim HaLeviim, then it's really only just a reference to the Kohanim, and there is no special status for the Leviim itself. The good news is, the Mishnah Berurah says, it's a good idea to accord privileged status to the Levi as well, if there's no Kohen. That is the follow-up discussion to that. So these are some very interesting comments with regards to how Parshas Emor, number one, comes from the Parsha to our everyday experience, but specifically paying attention to the way it came from the Parsha, of course within the miskeret of the Parsha Shir. So these are a few comments with regards to mitzvahs of Kohanim. And from there, I'd like to move to Parshas HaMoadim, which is to be found in Perek Kaf Gimel. And I would like to pay attention to aspects of the Parshas HaMoadim that are not, first and foremost, connected to the Moadim, because every Moad will talk about the relevant psukim. But there are certain psukim within Vayikra Perek Kaf Gimel that are neither here nor there in terms of a Moad per se. And they need to be discussed within the context of Parshas Emor. And a classic example of that is Pasuk Kaf Beis. Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Kaf Beis. So what do we have? We're approximately halfway through Parshas Moadim. We've discussed Pesach and Omer and Shavuos. We have yet to talk about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot. And in the middle of everything comes this Pasuk. Uvekutzrachem es kitzir artzachem. When you reap the harvest, lo sechale pa'asodcha bekutzrecha. Do not take the corners. That's the mitzvah of Peah. Veleket kitzircha lo selaked. You dropped a few, don't go back for them. Le'ani veleket tazovasam. Leave them. You leave them for the needy. And of course, the question is, this pasuk, it seems to have dropped in from the middle of nowhere. It's not about Yom Tov. It's very important, but it seems to be out of place. That's a sign from the fact that it's already been mentioned in Parshas Kedoshim, the mitzvahs of Lekachikra and Peah. So what does this teach us? Rashi comments. So Rashi's first comment is the fact that if there's an extra prohibition, an extra presentation of the prohibition to remove the corners of the field, etc., that means that a person violates two prohibitions. Okay, that one needs to know. And now, what is it doing here? Says Rashi. Amar Rabbi Abdimi b'Rabbi Yosef. Mara'a hakosuv litnam be'emsa haragolim. What is this pasuk doing in the middle of everything? We're in the middle of Yom Tov discussions, and all of a sudden, Matnas Aniyim. Pesach Atzeres Mikan, you've got Pesach HaTshavuos on this side, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur and Mikan. What does it teach you? Lelamedcha. It teaches you, Shekolanosein leket v'shikcho peyel la'oni kara'ui. A person who gives these mitzvahs correctly, properly, corners of the field and the things that he forgot. Ki'ilu bona beis hamikdash, v'hikriv olav korbanosav besocho. Like he built a Beis HaMikdash and brought Korbanos. In other words, Vayikra Kaf Gimel is all about Yom Tov, and the special feature of Yom Tov is the Korbanos of the Musafim. I mean, that's what they're doing in Parshas in Chumash Vayikra. Their mention within the context of Vayikra is because of special Korbanos that are brought. And now the Pasuk puts these gifts to the poor to teach you that if you perform these gifts properly, it's like you brought a Korban. And the question, of course, is, in what way is it like you brought a korban? I mean, they're two separate things. They're both good deeds. They're both positive mitzvahs. But what's the comparison to a korban? And this question is discussed by the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. And Maharal has a couple of comments which are most illuminating, as always. Firstly, says Maharal, we need to understand that the notion of bringing a korban, bringing a sacrifice to God, giving it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what does that mean? What is there to give to him? HaKadosh Baruch Hu per se never receives anything. We don't give to him. What we give is to his cause. In other words, there are certain things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says you're meant to do with your money. And the most overt example is bringing a korban to the Beis HaMikdash. But you should know that by extension, any time you use your money correctly to give it to God's cause, that's called giving it to God. That's all that it ever means anyway. And there's a fascinating pasuk in Mishlei which says, "Malva Hashem chonein dal." If you have compassion on the needy and give him money, it's like you're lending money to God. Money to God's cause is practically what we refer conceptually as giving money to God. So if you think that the only thing I can give to God is if I bring him a korban, so you need to know, you need to broaden your horizons. If you give it to the people that he says need it, and you give it under his directive, that's also called bringing a korban. That's using your money for God's cause. That's giving money to God. And what's fascinating is, says Maharal, and this highlights an aspect of korbanos that I'm not sure we often put at the center. And that is, korbanos comes from the word korban, karov, brings one closer. And we normally understand that to be true experientially. In other words, whatever the experience of bringing korban is, that creates a certain bond, both in the mystical realms and in the experiential realms. But the truth is, says Maharal, there's a much more basic aspect here. Korbanos are the ultimate avoda. They are the quintessential avoda. An avoda service is a function of an expression of a person's status as an eved, a servant. And what is the definition of an eved? The definition of an eved is a person who is entirely within the domain and under the jurisdiction and ownership of his master. That's an eved. And how is that expressed? It's expressed by a person using his resources in response to the directives of the master. That means if HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you need to bring a korban, so then the expense of bringing a korban means I respond to that because my resources are at the disposal of my master, because I'm his eved. And it's such a fascinating comment because it stresses the aspect of avoda that begins even before a person reaches the Beis HaMikdash. As soon as he goes to a farm to use his hard-earned money to purchase a korban that he has to bring, that is already an act of avoda, because his resources are at the disposal of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who says, you need to now bring a korban. Mashe kono eved, kono rabo. And therefore, says Maharal, when a person that acts similarly with his money, as if to say, I'm leaving the corners of my field for the Oni. Why am I doing that? Because God told me so, and everything that I own, he really owns. That means if it's true of my property, ultimately it's true of me. It's an act of avoda. The way that you look at your assets and who ultimately owns you is the ultimate expression of avoda. And this brings us to the final aspect of this discussion of the Maharal, which is quite subtle, I think. But that is, says Maharal, if that's true, then this should be true generally of tzedakah. It should, because in a sense, these mitzvahs are branches of tzedakah. They're very specific applications. Don't remove the corners of the field. If you dropped a few sheaves, don't drop a few stalks, don't go back for them. These are all specialized applications of the very general mitzvah of tzedakah. But if that's true, then it should be the mitzvah of tzedakah that's considered to be the equivalent of bringing a korban. But it was never said about tzedakah in general. It was said about these mitzvahs specifically. Why is that? And the answer, says Maharal, which is so fascinating, is that ironically, it's a great irony, in that tzedakah has less of this. And the reason why is tzedakah, giving charity, is a compassionate response to a person's need, which is a highly, highly important area of a person to be developed. But it's no longer the area of who my assets belong to. Because once it's a compassionate response, so in a sense, even if I view myself as the owner, but I'm a compassionate person, and therefore I'm giving my things to someone else. That's my decision of how to dispose of my assets in a compassionate way. It is not a statement that my assets are ultimately owned by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's saying, I would like to be a compassionate person. That is the weakness, so to speak, of these mitzvahs, is their strength in this respect. The fact that you leave it for, you don't even go near it. And those are the words of the Pasuk. Le'aniv lager ta'azovo sam. Don't even touch them. Don't even pick them up to give them to someone. Just keep your hands off. It's not yours. So in a sense, it's missing from the compassion aspect of tzedakah, because it's not in response to a person. You've gone home but before the aniyim come. You don't know what their plight, and you don't share in their struggle, their difficulties. But what you have done, aside from having provided for them, is that this is a much more emphatic expression of the fact that ultimately what belongs to me really belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I don't even take all of it home. When he says to leave, I leave it alone. And that's why the korban aspect comes out more for the things that I don't touch than the things that I pick up and out of compassion give to somebody else. Each one develops the person in a different way. So this is the very true to darko, we may say, explanation of the Maharal. And I would like, again, still keeping our eye on the parshanut of the matter, to move to the end of Perek Kaf Gimel. The Moedim begin with Pesach, and they end with Sukkos. But I would like to draw our attention to the following point. Sukkos is presented in Pasuk Lamed Gimel. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, Pasuk Lamed Dalet, daber el bnei Yisrael le'mor, b'chamisha asar yom l'chodesh ha'shvi'i hazeh, chag ha'sukkos shivas yomim l'Hashem. Okay. Vayemarikon bishan mikra kodesh, kol melech ha'sabadar lo sa'asu, etc., etc. So if Sukkos is described in Pasuk Lamed Dalet, and Lamed Hei, and Lamed Vav, or the korbanos, shivas yomim, takrivu shel Hashem. And then we come to Pasuk Lamed Zayin. And if we read Lamed Zayin and Lamed Ches together, we will certainly get a sense of what they are, how to place them. Eile moadei Hashem, asher tikru osam mikro'i kodesh, is Pasuk Lamed Zayin, la krivi shel Hashem, Ola u'mincha zevach u'nesachim d'var yom b'yomo. These are the mo'adim. That's it, Pasuk Lamed Ches, in a similar vein. Milvaz Shabbos Hashem, aside from the Shabbosos, and aside from your other voluntary offerings, these are the special Yomim Tovim. What is the point that we're looking to bring out? Eile Moade Hashem is a bracketing phrase. That's how it began, and that's how it ends. As if to say, in Pasuk, in the beginning of the parak, when it says Eile Moade Hashem, it is what is following is Moade Hashem. When it says it at the end of the parak, Eile Moade Hashem, it is a pasuk of summation, of conclusion, as if to say that was Moade Hashem. Fine. So you have that pasuk at the beginning introducing the Moadim, and then you have the pasuk as the Moadim closed. What's interesting is, if we read Pasuk Lamed Tes, we will come to realize that we haven't finished talking about Yom Tov yet. There's a good few things about Sukkot that we still need to discuss. Pasuk Lamed Tes, ach, wait! Lachamisha also lachodesh hashvi ba'ospechem es tuas haaretz tachog v'zchag Hashem shivas yomim. On the 15th of Tishrei, it's Sukkot. Okay, I thought we knew that. In fact, I thought we'd finished talking about that, but apparently we haven't. The special mitzvahs here. Ulekachtem lachem b'yom rishon the arba minim priyitz hadar kapos tmorim anaisavos arvei nachal. And there's another mitzvah in pasuk mem gimel pasukas teishu shivas yomim. So we have a most unusual situation here, because the parsha of Moados ended before it was over. It had the concluding psukim, Eile Moadei Hashem. That was it. Moadei Hashem. Next. Except there's more of Moadei Hashem. So what to make of this? Everything was inverted. The ending happened prematurely. And this question is discussed by Rav Waldenberg. And the Tzitz Eliezer, of course, Rav Waldenberg is a great posek. Most of the Tzitz Eliezer is Psak Halacha, but every once in a while he comes to discuss other things. And he raises this question. And he says, in explanation, that in order to understand what's happening here, we will need to ask a more basic question. As we have mentioned, there are two mitzvahs that accompany Sukkot, Arba Minim and Sukkot. Now the question is, when was the first time these mitzvahs began to apply to the Jewish people? When did they begin to be obligated in these mitzvahs? Now our intuitive response is straight away. However, says Rav Waldenberg, let's stop and think. Let's take them one by one. Arba Minim. Not only has the Pasuk said, and if we go back to Lamed Tes, which introduces the Arba Minim, B'chamisha Asar Yom, L'chodesh Hashvi, B'os B'chem Estvuos Ha'aretz, in a sense, Sukkot is being presented anew and is being framed as when you bring in the produce of the land. Which is very interesting. Because if that's the case, then Sukkot actually now has two capacities to it. It exists on two levels. It is Chag HaSukkos, an inseparable part of the Shalosh Regalim. It's a Yom Tov. It's a Mikra Kodesh. That will be instantly true and needs to be related as such. But there are other dimensions to Sukkot. There are, for example, the Arba Minim. And it is very possible to say that the mitzvah of Arba Minim has been introduced and characterized by these words, Ba'os Bechem Es Tivuas Ha'aretz. You brought in the harvest, now that leads to celebration with the Arba Minim. If you're in the middle of the desert, there is no harvest yet. Doesn't mean there's no Sukkot yet. But the aspect of Sukkot that's harvest related, not yet. Moreover, there is a fascinating explanation of the mitzvah of Arba Minim. There was so much to say about Arba Minim, and most of it we leave for Sukkot. But the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim, in Chelek Gimel, the end of Perek Mem Gimel, discusses, in Chelek Gimel he discusses more or less all the mitzvahs, and his words regarding Arba Minim are as follows. This is a Kapach's translation. Va'asher nirli ba'arba minim shebalulav. What seems to me the correct understanding of Arba Minim, well, what's it all about? Shehi simcha v'soson ayitziyosa min hamidbar. Arba Minim is a celebration of having finally gotten through the desert. Shehilo mekom zera, te'ena v'gefen v'rimon, u'mayim ayin l'shtos, to quote the words of the Jewish people when they were thirsty. Nothing grows in the desert. And here we are in Eretz Yisrael, having been taken from the Midbar, El Mekom Atzei Priva Naharos, to a place where things grow, to a place where there's rivers. Lefichach Nilkach Lezikaron Lekach. It's amazing, because most of the Yomim Tovim we call Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim. But this aspect of Sukkot, says the Rambam, is Zecher Liyetzias Hamidbar, which was itself part of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And that's why we take all these beautiful things. They look nice. Hano'esh Peruseha, these beautiful fruits. Bal hareach hatov, they smell nice, some of them. Va'alim hano'im, nice leaves. So this is fascinating. According to the Rambam, the mitzvah of Arba Minim is a hoda'ah for having finally gotten through the desert and entered into Eretz Canaan. And this is concurred with by the Abarbanel in his Perush on Parshas Emor, and he adds a fascinating point. Because I think probably the one of the Arba Minim that gets the least press, shall we say, are the Aravos. Because your Hadassim and the Lulav and the Esrog, I mean, they're the ones that will set you back financially. And they are the ones that are the focus of all of the attention because there's so much to say about them, and it's fruit, and it smells nice. And the Arvei Nachal, they're there, but what exactly do they represent? And amazingly, according to the Abarbanel, the Arvei Nachal are the most basic of the Arba Minim. Because they're Arvei Nachal. They grow by water. Arvei Nachal are brought as a hogdor from having been taken through a place where there's no water to a place where there is water. Now, of course, the Aravos are kosher even if they don't grow by a stream. But the Torah calls them Arvei Nachal because they remember water. And, of course, so much of Sukkot is connected to water. Nisach HaMayim, and that's when we start to ask for a Gishmei Bracha, etc., etc. And it's a whole new perspective on the part that the Arava plays. It doesn't represent a fruit. It represents the water that it grows by. And that's part of the Hodah. Ad kedekach, mayim chayim. If that's the case, says Rav Waldenberg, there is ample room to suggest that the Jewish people who are yet in the Midbar did not yet have the mitzvah of Arba Minim. I mean, they're still in the desert. And what about Sukkot? What about the other mitzvah, the sister mitzvah of Sukkot? Well, this is a question which is discussed by an earlier authority, the Mabit, Rabbeinu Moshe ben Yishai Mitrani. He lived in Tzfat. He was a member of the Beis Din along with Rabbi Yosef Karo. And he has a sefer called Beis Elokim. And he states in a very straightforward manner. The Pasuk itself has said that the reason behind, and the Pasuk doesn't always give reasons for the mitzvahs, but here it does. Pasukos teishu shivas yomim, lemani du derosechin, give us sukkos hashavti. The reason that the Torah gives for the mitzvah of sukkah is, remember that you sat in sukkos. Now, when is it necessary to remember that you sat in sukkos? When you're no longer sitting in sukkos. But if you live in a sukkah in the Midbar, you don't need to be reminded. It doesn't need to be part of your yom tov to remember the time that you lived in a sukkah. Because that was yesterday, today, and tomorrow. There exists a debate, as we know, well-known debate, as to whether or not the references to sukkos mamash, real sukkos or anane hakovet, says them a bit. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is that we're commemorating, they had it. They don't need to commemorate something that they're experiencing. And therefore, this brings us to a conclusion that it may well be that the reason why Perek Kaf Gimel closed before it finished describing all of the mitzvahs is because at this stage it has already finished presenting the mitzvahs as they apply to Dor HaMidbar. And that's finished. There's nothing else that they need to know. There are further mitzvahs that they will that will be applicable in the future. But Yom Tov, as far as you're concerned, you already know everything you need to know by Pasuk Lamed Zayin. And what's fascinating is this will give us an added appreciation of Pasuk Lamed Dalet. For if we go back to Pasuk Lamed Dalet, it says, when it introduces Sukkos, Daber Avnei Yisrael Lemor, B'chamisha Asar Yom, the 15th Lachodesh Hashvi'i Hazeh. Hag Sukkos Shivas Yomim Lachodesh. Literally, what's being presented is on the 15th of this Tishrei will be Sukkos. The implication is next Sukkos will be different. In what respect? In respect to the fact that this Sukkos, all you have for your mitzvah Sukkos are the korbanos. But of course, the plan was at that stage that by this time next year there should be an Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, this should be the only Sukkos, it was scheduled to be the only Sukkos, year one, that the only aspects that they had to the Chag of Sukkos were the Korbanos. This Tishrei, only the Korbanos. L'shana haba, ba'ara di Yisrael. And then you'll have all of these other mitzvahs, which are then followed up. So that's a very interesting analysis of this Parshas Hamor. I'd like to conclude by making reference to the final episode of the Parsha, which is in Perek Kaf Dalet, the Parsha of the Mekalel. There's a great deal to speak about. But there was an altercation with very drastic reactions, and someone cursed God's name, and in the end he was put to death. It was a very sobering episode at the end of the Parsha. And let's take a look at Pasuk Yudalad. We're in Perek Kaftalad. Pasuk Yudalad. What do? They don't know what to do. So they're told what to do. Pasuk Yudalad. Hotseyas HaMekalel El Michutz LaMachaneh. He needs to be taken out and needs to be killed. V'rogmuo so kolo eda. And that's the din from this point onwards. Ish ishki kalel elokav v'nasav. If a person repeats that offense, would ever do that, he would bear the consequences. Okay. Then we have five psukim, which once again seem to come out of nowhere. What do they say? V'ishki ake kol nefesh adam mos yumos. If a person kills someone, he needs to be killed. If he kills an animal, he has to pay for it. Pasuk Yutes, v'ishki ten mumba amiso. If he harms his friend, so then he needs to make restitution. There's another expression of ayin tachas ayin, and that's the law. And the question is, what are all these halachas doing within the context of the parsha of the Mekalel? The Mekalel did what he did. You need to know the halacha. Everything else is parshas mishpatim. What's it doing? Being stated again at the end of parshas Emor. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, really, al derech hapshat, very interestingly, these people had a fight, these two, the Ben HaYisraelis and the Isha Yisraeli. Vayinotsu b'machaneh, says Pasuk Yud. They had a fight. Now what's interesting is, we get swept up in a sense in the drama of the fact that one of them ended up doing this terrible thing, and he cursed God's name, and in the end he was killed. But there are other aspects to the situation that shouldn't be ignored. If they fought with each other, they may have injured each other. They may have damaged each other. They may have damaged each other's property. And we may have tended to kind of forget about that, set against the more severe prohibition. But if all of those things happen, there are liabilities incurred. They shouldn't be forgotten. And moreover, and therefore, the principal issue at hand, of course, is his capital offense. But there are other halachas that need to be reviewed here. Did he cause damage before he did that? to someone damage here? There are halachas here. They shouldn't fall by the wayside. And in fact, Rav Yaakov suggests that the final pasuk of the parasha, "Vayidaber Moshe al bnei Yisrael, vayitziu es hamekal al michutz lamachane, vayugmu eso oven." So they took him out and they killed him. And then the final words of the parsha are rather puzzling. "Uvenei Yisrael asu kasher tziv Hashem es Moshe." And the Bnei Yisrael acted in accordance with how Hashem commanded Moshe. And the question that everybody asks is, what is this referring to? We just said that they killed him, and that's the end of the story. Says Rabbi Yaakov, no, that's the point. There were other aspects that needed to be taken care of. There were this financial restitution. Other people shouldn't suffer just because he got killed. And that's the reference to the final words. Number one, they put him to death. That was the burning issue at hand. But beyond that, they took care of everything else that the parsha had spoken about. He caused damage, or someone damaged him prior to that. They have no license. That doesn't get it just ignored. It also has to be taken care of. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a different approach to this issue. Our question is, what are these halachas of damage is doing and set against the cursing of God's name? So Rav Moshe says something well worth contemplating. A person who's prepared to curse God's name is someone who has very little holding them back from doing any form of damage that they feel will further their ends. In other words, if there is no sense of a presence that binds them, a higher presence that they have to answer to, so then if anything gets in their way, they'll deal with it in the most effective way possible. And ultimately, this echoes the sentiment of the Malbim. It's a well-known comment of the Malbim, Parshas Vayera. Avram lied to Abimelech. He said Sarah was his sister, not his wife. Why? They said, why not? He said, "Amarti af ki ein yiras elokim b'makom hazeh." There's no fear of God in this place. "Varaguni al devarishti." They'd kill me over my wife. And the Malbim says they may have been civilized, they may have been cultured, but if there was no sense of being bound by this, the ultimate absolute authority of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they can bend the rules. If in a godless existence, so a person's moral compass changes with the wind. Anything is possible. Changes with the weather. And it's interesting that this reverberates with a parallel comment of the Malbim in his Perush to Megillas Rus, whereby we know from the Talmud that Boaz made a certain takana. He was the head of the Sanhedrin. He made a takana that people should use God's name when they say hello to each other. They should she'eshoel es shalom chaveru b'shem. And in fact, the way that was implemented was by saying shalom. Because shalom is the name of Hashem. Vayikra lo Hashem shalom. We say atah shalom, v'shimcha shalom. And saying shalom is a takana of Boaz. That they should greet each other with God's name. Says the Malbim, where did this takana come from? What's the background of it? Why now? Says the Malbim, this was a response to the climate of as is presented by the beginning of Megillas Rus. Vayihi bimei shafot hashoftim. The judging of the judges, it's not as nice as it sounds. It's not the judges judging, it's the judges being judged. It was a time that justice itself was being judged. And people, it was a time of upheaval, of unrest, of unrest. And Ish kol ha'yoshev ein av yaseh, that's almost like the byword for the tkuf of the shoftim. Ish kol ha'yoshev ein av yaseh. And therefore, Boaz is saying, what people are missing, is they're missing a God awareness. If they were more conscious of God as a presence in their lives, so there's room to be more optimistic that there wouldn't be such chaos in society. And therefore he says, when you say hello to your friend, say God's name. To paraphrase, Boaz was looking to put the ale back into Yisrael. He was looking to bring back a God awareness into life that should make a difference to the social structure. And that remains true. And this is the comment, it's a very sobering comment, really, of Rav Moshe, because what he's saying is, if you live in a society where a person is capable of cursing God's name, you need to develop expertise in two areas of halacha. Number one, Hilchos cursing God's name. Number two, any other area of damage. Because there's very little now standing between one and the other. And these are sentiments certainly well worth reflecting. There are places where God's name is part of the day-to-day conversation, and places where it isn't. And very often, it's the difference between whether additional school funding is set aside for a nicer playground or more sophisticated metal detectors. Maybe in the oven. We'll leave it over there for this evening.